Blog Talk Radio.
ZZ Top would say, hi, good morning and good afternoon and good evening, wherever you are. It's a pleasure to have you sit in with us some sonic effects again. We have a good show today. The commentary, bright, I think you'll find engaging, at least that's the intention again. The poetry of William Haley, a guy that hung around with William Blake, for any of you who are familiar with the artwork and poetry and writings and influence of William Blake. Interesting guys. And we're fortunate that, you know, like this great big time sieve, masonry seems to be able to catch these pearls. And if we think about the movement of ideas, you know, it's very fluid. There's always, the mind's always working. And sometimes we can get to the point where we're looking at things from so many different angles. Not just for those who have been living with their eyes closed. Sometimes within masonry, they start to open a bit, and they realize certain things that they've been doing have been misjudgments, miscalculations, and at times they'll begin to wonder, or if they're prompted by some fool like me, they'll start to practice some of the old skills. Many of them are quite applicable. Like, particularly, I'm fascinated with rhetoric and what it gives us. You think to be able to consider. Although, let's say the effort is for us to value what we're saying, to not speak unless we have something useful to contribute. That's a premise that this is built on. Then think that you can actually be trained to think through the eyes, to see the world, to see ideas, in a sense, through the eyes of other people, through the eyes of the people you're speaking with. Not only this assumes that you already know your own thinking, unless you want to, you have that need to brag. You know, it's very unpleasant, but, a lot of men do that. A lot of little men do that, they want to bring attention to something. The other night I heard a fellow from Pennsylvania carrying on like a evangelist at a tent meeting. I just shook my head, okay, you carry on with that. I don't buy anything that he didn't, couldn't really swallow anything that he was saying. It was just, stuff you'd heard in the 40s and 50s, perhaps. But to be able to think through and develop a sense of the rhetoric, of seeing of being able to argue toward what you're saying to make your point. Let's argue. I mean argument in that point, sense, not crushing defeat of the enemy. Jeez. To be able to see the argument from the other's point of view strengthens your thinking, and allows for us to review our own thinking. When we do that, do we see flaws? Do we see inconsistencies? Do we see illogical manners? It's fascinating. And the worth in social discourse, the value of that is persuasion, because you're saying more. The simple rules are, when you're working with talking or engaging somebody, you always look for, you begin with the points of agreement, and in every diplomacy 101, but you begin with the points of agreement, and soon enough, if you're anyway intelligent, you certainly don't need to embellish or advance that. That becomes evident when you have two thinking people trying to talk and come to some understanding. And usually, if we're successful, the understandings are something that they're a bit of compromise that everybody in the room can live with. It means that everybody's giving just a little bit, but everybody can tolerate a little bit. And then it works, because the view is not only on asserting one's own, to develop that sense of compromise, of unity, of common purpose. It comes in fits and spurts. Little battles, not the big ones, not big ones. You don't start off with that. You need training wheels. Start off with this little conversations, and you do them over and over and over until you get a little better at them. Then you can begin to take the training wheels off. Well, imagine being able to do that just generally. You don't just do that in a Masonic lodge and then turn your brain off. The notion that masonry is practiced out there in the real world is quite true. Where we learn it in the sanctum sanctorum is to give us that sense of importance. Underlines the sense of importance, not of the material, but of ourself and our thoughts and our purpose. And for that, we're given an opportunity to explore. And by exploring, we mean to question and to doubt and to reason and to apply critical thinking, to learn what critical thinking can do, and then decide whether we're going to apply that or not. But if not, then at least step out of the way of other men who are moving on with that purpose. We haven't reached that point yet. We're still at a state of confusion, right? Even with the changes going on, there's still some. So, and it's not altogether unhealthy. A bit of doubt or skepticism really does trigger off the most wonderful conversations. I'm not thinking about the blunt force kind of conversation that has, I don't know, that's too self-serving, but where it's nuanced, where you can examine aspects. So there may be something that, in the totality of what you said, it's more likely that there's one small aspect that I don't agree with than the entire body of your thinking. But if I'm just use some of the I always drag my dear old friend out. It's more black and white, you know. It is, and you become upset about it, which apparently validates thinking. It doesn't, but it's a convention that we find and gets us out of the hook. You can leave the room; you don't have to sit there and listen to more of the murk. But take masonry and the seven liberal arts. Well, I'm saying you're not different than the boys that wrote this up. I'm not different. I mean, we were there, different configurations. But my goodness, of course, we're unique in every way. We have idiosyncrasies. Yes, there's no question about that. But we do have a lot of similarity, and we can learn from that. When this history has an appeal because it's relevance. We apply it. When we can apply what we've done before to ourselves today, that history is relevant. In a sense, it continues to live, if I can put it that way. And we continue to benefit of as what we're talking about here, and the threads are through our ritual. So I'm not going to beat that. That's just, I won't go there much anymore. It's obvious. The idea of the ideas are contained in our ritual, the time and time again, but they're of little avail if we don't take time to understand them. And understanding in itself is an interesting phenomenon, because what we think and decide and calculate today may not be pertinent to the same question being asked if we change the time frame, if we look at things in 5-year gaps, intervals. Will the answer be the same? Well, you would wonder just by the nature of the question whether we're searching out refinements. Are we thinking that some properties of this question might be refined over the years, and we can compare what we knew then with what we know now. And we keep an open mind about it so that we're not just opinionated and fearful and determining that it's things that are unfamiliar are somehow wrong. Every day the world around us is unfamiliar. You and I don't have the sense of a prophecy. We're uncomfortable, my goodness, we're uncomfortable about these discussions about reality and different temporal states. We're uncomfortable because it's hard to think that way. Interesting questions are about whether we're living an illusion. Is everything around us illusion? And I think it's fascinating to be in a position 21st century where we're asking, but I'm more interested in what we're going to produce that will be a leg up for the 22nd century. You would think that the questions in the minds of 22nd century Masons would be somehow connected with our past, just as we are rooting through the history. We find these big words are helpful. Epistemology is helpful because it describes a lot. It's like a thinking code. It describes a lot, but do we know the words? Well, if you seriously have not studied, if you're not giving yourself or the words the attention and the amount of time it takes to absorb them, you might want to do yourself a favor and think about doing that now. To take the time and invest, you begin to look at the idea from different sides. And sometimes it becomes quite evident, but don't necessarily, I want you to be cautious, not necessarily think that every time you tackle an idea, you're intelligent if you absorb it right away, and you're foolish if you can't. Some of the more important ideas in life require a great deal of contemplation. And who's to say when the light is going, when the pieces and the logic is going to fit together? Who's to say that? Somebody else? Well, you separate yourself from the men and the boys in a way, the women and the girls, if you will. This has nothing to do with a gender bias, nothing at all. You think that ideas are going to be moving. Ideas and notions about Freemasonry is fluid. It's not static because somebody says it is. It's fluid because all of the players in it are fluid. The people coming forward, the people that are dying. There's fluidity. There's change. Time does that with us, and we can follow different threads of thinking. And the beauty of Masonry gives us that framework. We have the historical framework, and you begin with that pivot point, 1717, and then you find maybe not 1717. And if you get into the question of start, well, we're not looking at London. No. That was a business plan, you know. It was organization. Yes, it was business. It was organization. Could it have happened without shouldering of imperialism? I don't know, but probably not the way it turned out as it is. You know, moving around the globe the way it did wasn't as if there was fairy dust in the air. These were practical men with practical missions, and they carried their history and culture with them. And it underlines the sense that today, where I am, new continent, which wasn't that new, it was on rock that is billions of years old. We don't have writings, and we don't have the songs, and we don't have the chants of the. When we tried to, where I am, we tried to kill the native population because that's what conquerors did. They exploited, they killed, they murdered, and that's what they did. So what's left is us learning from those mistakes, learning to the horror of many of us. What happens when we try to censor existence in the world? Doesn't work very well. Masonry is opening things up because it is a universal practice. Universality is at the heart of it. But if you don't mind, could you sit back and we'll start the show as we like to, with some really decent music. This is my favorite French performer, one of my favorites, Michel Petrucciani, no longer with us, but nevertheless. That was Michel Petrucciani, early years, early in his career, between 1981 and 85. Yeah, you can tell he developed quite a bit since then, didn't he? Quick commentary today. Tell me your thoughts on this one. This is about, you know, we talk at different points about the value in taking time to invest in the question that you're asking. often, and as a rule of thumb, some very beautiful old professors would tell me that the answer, a lot of the work, the serious work, you know, during primary research, is realized in the way that the question is developed and phrased. And kind of again, it's if you think about it, you can ask a question that be a waste of time, or you can within the question you can find a different levels of precision. And this is one of those thoughts that occurred. And by the way, I'm feeling I'm looking at opportunity. There is opportunity here. I feel like I'm in an investment market in a way, but I don't mean that at all. There is always opportunity for ideas to be developed and move forward. And nobody, no organization, though they try, organizations, the politics always will try to narrow the conversation, and it always fails. It interrupts it, but it generally fails. Masonry, we don't use that kind of harsh language, but we can see that there's that strain. Always that strain to not get into, you know, don't want to get into too much of the metaphysical, because we'd have to define it and understand it, and my Lord, we can't control it. Questions are at the heart of exploration. Now, I'm patting myself on the back for that one. That's skepticism isn't intrinsically fear or alarm. Mm-hmm. When people overthink, it can harden into cynicism, especially if we are impressionable. Whoever claimed you can't teach an old dog new tricks is guessing. I doubt they ever had a dog. Instead of fearing questions, we encourage them. We turn them from unpleasant emotion into inspiration and meaning. We take hold of ideas, and when they are precarious, as some are, our best are drawn into the frame. Saying I don't know is akin to asking for directions when out for a drive. Many men, overwhelmed with pride, are unable to accept the help. We laugh at them and ourselves now. What does this say about our future? It's rosy. We are still becoming accustomed to a flood of knowledge. Gradually, we will assimilate that information. We're struggling more with it than our children are. Our children are born to it. Don't be bitter. Don't be angry about that. That's, oh my goodness, it's so unfair. Yeah, well, everything about you is unfair. Right? Everything about me. Gradually, we will assimilate. And thank goodness next generations are giving us a leg up on that, because they just don't stop there. They continue just like we did in our day. It is already generating discussion and intellectual honesty. When we get there, we find we have information that can be put to use, refining our thinking and our processes. There's nothing new about this. History tells us this type of genius has happened around the globe in cultures perhaps as far back as 2000 BC. I think more. A tidal wave of research has revealed every nuanced flaw in our makeup and thrown them into the light without teaching how to close this Pandora's box. After the box was emptied of dangers and doubt, it still held a single aspect, didn't it? Remember what was left in the box when all that was gone? Hope. Hope. Is this why pre-Christian faiths are surging? Gratefully, humans have continued to make sense out of existence. Oddly, or perhaps not oddly at all, the ancient religions and beliefs are back, if they ever left. While it might be worse to think we live in interesting times, as the Chinese phrase goes, we could add, we live in amazing times. Without asking anyone to adapt, to bend over so far that at times it hurts, we move on into whatever tomorrow brings. Find the contentment if you can. Those that come up against those barriers where they have to, where compromise requires a bit of a bend, are legion. There's lots of them. But those that have to reason through, who can reason through and bend over so back far backwards that it feels like their back is going to break, those are people that bring us forward. Those are people that bring us forward. Now, all of that, it might sound lofty, except when you're in that mood that you find in our lodges. You know the mood where you're, it resonates. I haven't acquired that sense of frisson. Maybe, you know, I've been, you know, overwhelmed by some of the great halls, Masonic halls, just. And I'm one of those folks that likes the clever detail that isn't overstated. Detroit Masonic Hall is institutes like that. They're full of these little charms. Oh, it's brilliant. The threads of these ideas take us through asking why and what and the essentials. And when you start to ask about the essentials, you begin to examine yourself. We're given a great, beautiful, beautiful mirror, a very ornate mirror in it. And the face looking back in it, it might be puzzled one day and smiling the next. But there's a sense of wonderment. And you get a choice. You can go through it like that, dour and uncomfortable and a cliche of everything old and tedious, you know, the kind of stuff about men, that groups of men that make people want to avoid us. Yeah, you can do all of that, or you can celebrate it and realize that you can be comfortable within your own skin. You can be comfortable and engaging with the people around you, and you can make a contribution. Sometimes it's with support. There's many ways of supporting things. You can support art galleries and charitable events and theater with your ticket price or your donations. You can support things morally. By understanding the implications and applications, we take that, and it's not to trivialize it. It's to remind us that we strengthen ourselves. We become a little stronger day by day. When we begin to understand a principle life, we just understand what the hell it is that anybody's talking about, and whose principles and what are they and what's wrong with the ones that I already have. And so, you know, it's as simple as saying you were born with them. And how do you know that? You just say it. Well, saying something doesn't mean it's so. And then we move on. And generation by generation, you think about this, that even if 1% of the candidates that came to our door were absolutely stunningly equipped to explore the depths of masonry, we would learn from them. We would learn a considerable amount, because they wouldn't be falling into line. And they wouldn't be looking around to make their decisions based on what the people in the room are thinking. They will be able to have that, you know, inward sense, that inward confidence that they're not rash, but they're able to weigh propositions in their fullness. In other words, they're able to see the other side. They're able to see the point and counterpoints. Fortunately, there are within that 1% or 2%, there are also men capable of looking at things from many more sides, the facets of decisions and thinking. That's not necessarily empowering. That can be quite disemboweling, because you can get into the paralysis. We see all these things. Oh my goodness, there must be something right in all of this. Well, very often depends on the timing and the setting. You know, rightness is something that is tremendously qualified. It scares the hell out of me when somebody walks around with this sense of rightness, this doctrinaire sense of rightness. Demagogues do it a lot, and we have our share of them running around. They always have. We have, you know, there's messiahs always running around and clothed differently and saying different things, but it's always been there. And then all these old faiths and old ways of thinking, old, ancient, are being renewed, and we're seeing the sacred feminine again. Did we ever think that organized religions had slipped into a way of thinking that may not have been in the best interest of the entire globe? Yeah, I'll leave that for the theologians in the colleges to help us to understand. They're rewriting things all the time. Scripture's being reframed so that it's understood, even when we're trying to maintain something in its purity. Even saying that and starting to talk about it changes ideas. Just the very mention. If we start to do it, when we start to apply words, we start to narrow things down. We start to define things. And what are we left with? Well, we're left with this array of people, this beautiful spectrum from people that could care less to people that are searching for meaning. Masonry welcomes the searchers. The could care less don't really find a good fit in Masonry. The flattery, yeah, the pretentiousness, well, it is what it is, but we weren't built on that stuff here. Here, and to prove my point, here's Stan Getz and Charlie Bird. Yeah, 1962. Thank you. For those of you who are no longer Hepcats, like my friend Cliff Sagal used to call us, Hepcats. He was of that era in the 30s and 40s when everybody was Hep and the cool guys were Hepcats. If you were tuning the radio in the dash of your big your dad's Merc, 1962, that song was a hit on the hit parade. I'm going to, I've talked with you before about William Blake, the poet and painter, and I especially like stories about people that weren't known in their own time. He was largely unrecognized in his life, was William Blake. I've talked about his poetry previously. And part of the reason I have to admit is that he is now considered, as they say, and as I'm told, he's considered a seminal figure in the history of the poetry and visual art of the Romantic Age. We were coming of age where we were talking about the sensory experience. We're talking about the engagement with the world around us. And before, you know, that inner soul, that inner message, that inner life was generally not mentioned. We looked at a world of externalities, largely. Now, this guy... But he's not the poet I'm going to talk about today. The poet I'm bringing forward today is William Haley. Now, he was a patron, you know, in the day. While you may not recognize the name, he was born in 1745. So after that 1717, you know, where the Big Bang started in London and up in Scotland, they were wondering what the fuss was about. This guy was a patron of the arts. You know, he was, and he's best remembered for his friendship with William Blake. Blake was referred to as a pre-romantic poet and painter and designer. And he was friends of William Cowper, the 18th century poet. So this guy was known. However, Blake referred to him. He liked him enough. Haley, in 1800, he invited Blake and his wife to live in a cottage on his Feltham estate. and to continue engraving and printing illustrations for his books. But he failed, apparently he failed to understand Blake's visionary genius. This failure caused Blake, he was happy with the countryside, you know, it's gorgeous. And if you're thinking about inspiration, wouldn't you want to do that to somebody, do that for somebody that's creative? He referred to, and despite his gratitude for Haley's generosity, he saw him as an, quote, an enemy of my spiritual life, while pretending to be the friend of my corporeal. So it, 3 years later, 1803, realizing that Haley's wish to turn him into a tame parrot poet, an engraver and miniature painter, would destroy his artistic integrity, Blake returned to London, and he immortalized Haley in an epigram. Thy friendship oft has made my heart to ache. Do be my enemy for friendship's sake. The influence. Now, if you've ever realized that being around certain groups of people and their thinking is toxic or toxic to your vision, your need for an intellectual or spiritual kind of an emergence or growth, then you'll know what the lament of William Blake about William Haley. But here's nevertheless, press on, William Haley. I'm going to share with you a bit of one of his poems. This one's called The Swan. Now you'll see, I don't think it's the design that, you know, you're not going to mistake it for Blake or the other notables, I don't think. This guy's work has also moved along through time in relative obscurity, as William Haley. So why the obscurity? Tastes change. It's like all of the musicians that have been journeymen for decades, and all of a sudden they're discovered. The protege that was mismanaged and suffers from overexposure, and there's lots of musicians like that. The mockery. If you're a guitar fan, you'll remember Peter Frampton, who's marketed as a pretty boy, a very, very talented musician, still performing to this day. You know, when you look at when musicians find their way into audiences to listen to these people, you know that they're looking beyond the marketing and what you and I are told we ought to believe about things. We get that a lot, don't we? The swan, kind heaven will oft a lesson give if mortals are inclined to learn. I think that's fair. To show how simplest things that live to kindness make a rich return. Though fiction speaks of dying notes sung by the swan in death resigned, is there a tribe that flies or floats or sense of feeling less refined? Yet simple as this bird we deem, my faithful ballad shall attest, one swan displayed on Thames stream a feeling and a friendly breast. Cecilia lived on Thames bank, a young and lovely married fair, two creatures kind of every rank, a favorite swan had owned her care. Her lord, a merchant frank and young, by probity was known to thrive. Their bliss enlivened every tongue. They were the happiest pair alive. For to increase their nuptial joy and their domestic scene adorn, heaven crowned their blessings with a boy. A finer boy was never born. His sportive life had only run to 6 short months. How brief a date when gay Cecilia's darling son was threatened with a deadly fate. Her garden had a terrace fair, Beneath it, full, the river flowed, and there she enjoyed the evening air. Her favorite swan there proudly rode, the mother in her active arms, to make her boy benignly mild and nobly proof against all alarms that oft would exercise her child. A boathouse by the terrace side sheltered a small and simple boat, and sometimes halfway o'er the tide, chains to its home, it used to float. Here she and her infant and her maid sport with the swan and gave it bread, while her gay boy of not afraid with lively transport sees it fed. 'Tis June, a sultry tempest wild impends. Cecilia would retire, but checks herself to teach her child the vivid lightning to admire. Her noble mind delights to rear in early fortitude her boy, that he the voice of God may hear with admiration's awful joy. While to regain the vessel's shed, she, her maid and active pilot stands, she to the music o'er her head dances the child with dauntless hands. But whirlwinds rise, the vessel reeled, heaven, the sweet parent is overthrown, her failing head fails to shield attentive to her child alone. 'Tis the tornado's ruthless blast, the mother stunned, the babe it bears. Far from her senseless frame, aghast, the maid in speechless horror glares. Yet swiftly to its proper shore, the whirlwind now the vessel drives, whereby the elemental roar alarmed, Cecilia's lord arrives. Into the boat, behold him bound, he lifts his lifeless wife up. She awakens to the thunder's sound. Her opening eyes regain the light. Where is my child? She faintly cries. Where is the child? Her lord rejoined. Poor heart-struck Susan not replies. The child has vanished from her mind. My child, with terror's start, she shrieks in accents wild and shrill. And at her agony of heart, the very tempest self grew still. Say if you saw him sink, she cried wildly to Susan, pale and wan. Then quick her roving eye descried the tall neck of her favorite swan. My God, 'tis thee, I think, exclaimed the now exulting fair. I see him wafted to the bank, his cradle formed by heavenly care. She spoke, and all who heard her cry now saw the babe divinely nursed, and the ecstatic sight from every eye made tears of grateful transport burst. Between her silvery arching wings, the guardian bird had lodged the child, and forward as her broad foot springs at every stroke, the infant smiled. And with the heaven-implanted pride superbly rode now to land, the brave bird has her charge denied to all but to the mother's hand. Cecilia, feeling now no pains, leans o'er the boat's advancing end and gained by her lord's reclaims the presence of her feathered friend. Now with delight the rescued boy to her maternal bosom springs. The conscious swan partakes their joy and claps her proud, triumphant wings. Celia beads to weep and pray. She weeps with joy no longer vain. And still on this returning day blesses the heaven-directed swan. Huh. It's gentle, isn't it? It's a lovely story. A lovely story. Huh. Imagine that. Thank you. His music is wonderful. If you're wanting to read or just have a contemplative afternoon with your glass of wine and feeling the breeze, or your sketches, it's wonderful. Or your book of poetry, Keith Jarrett, of course. Oh, today this portion of our history takes us into the world of stereotypes and misogyny. Unfortunately, it is a part of our history. And maybe it's necessary for us to be forced to conclude that a virtuous life it doesn't allow us these kind of simplistic indulgences. And we use, as a framework for this discussion, we're getting into it, we're looking at the material from Amsterdam, both the history of the lodge. The lodge is the reason this is so valuable is because there is so much detail. When we look at the minute books of many of our lodges today, it's indecipherable, it's like signatures on the ledger. They're indecipherable, so these people don't exist. It's 50 years from now, nobody will be able to tell, which is kind of pertinent when you think about it, or people don't care enough to do that. They just don't get remembered. They're not making much contribution. The way we think about ourselves, it has become a barrier when our beliefs are packed full of stereotypes that are not valid. The type that we're talking about today particularly aren't. A little bit of a spoiler alert. If you are prone to misogyny and your own prejudices about gender you have strong assumptions about the nature of Freemasonry, you're probably wiser to go and find that, go and dig out that nice bottle of brandy that you've been hiding and give us a few minutes to talk. And when you come back, this will all be gone and you won't be upset. I don't want to upset the boys. Here in the early decades of European Freemasonry, if we rely on printed apologies, all women would have been perforce among the profane world. All women were included in that. Anti-Masonic writers in the 1740s, yes, 1740s, 23 years after the start, the London start. No, it wasn't even the London start because there were lodges already in existence. So anyway, 1740 seized upon their exclusion from the lodges, but did so in order to imply that one found another criminal pleasures. Why there? Because the implication was the criminal pleasures. And writers like that often adopted a misogynist tone. My brain in my mouth. Misogynist tone presumed that the lodges were centers for the bacchanalian, and that women were more than eager to join them. You know, they were mocking us. They were saying we're just, the hoi polloi. We're just there to carry on in secret all those dirty little things. Yeah, that's dirty little minds make up dirty little things, accusations. And that's why it's the come in after the dirt that drew women to Freemasonry. An insult, which is the insult to human nature, to us, or to women? Can't tell. But anti-Masons made a point of it, pointing that out. And they were in fact, there was not much from which to choose in trying to recreate all the experience of Masonry like there is today, but what this may have meant to those few women finally admitted to the lodges to find this, we need to know the historical implications of their general exclusion. And that is what gender exclusion tells us about the nature of this new and enlightened fraternity. By the 1750s on the continent, gender exclusion within the fraternity had begun to break down. That's right, break down. Certain lodges now began formally to admit women. We must search to find any clues that reveal the presence of women prior to that decade. One such clue, as we saw in the introduction, turned up in the Parisian police reports. Forced to meet in private as opposed to public places, lodge brothers in the 1740s were arrested along with sisters. We have no sense that the women were present by contrivance or as a foil. They probably lived there. Yet a reminiscence by a French brother of the 1760s who had been in the fraternity in the 1730s may provide the best clue to understanding the pressures that forced the lodges to bring women into their confidence. Lecturing in Strasbourg, he recounts how in the time of Derwentwater, that is Lord Derwentwater, Grand Master until his resignation in 1738, and because of the papal condemnation, women were used as protectresses of the order. The brother is explicit about why their help was enlisted. Accusations of sexual license, in short, of sodomy, prompted the move. Yet when the innuendo and pressure lifted, so too did the interest in women's participation. So if I can gather what we're learning here is that in order to be an antidote for sodomy, for homosexuality is what they're talking about, you know, good Lord, they had women. They brought women into lodges. There, we couldn't possibly be homosexual because there's women here after all. How I'll leave the cynicism and callousness of this with you. Yet with the innuendo and pressure lifted, so did interest in women's participation. When the critics went away, they got bored. Oh, okay, we don't need women anymore in lodges. To better understand this reticence, we need to examine the Masonic meaning of the profane. This notion defined the borders of the Masonic polity, and predictably, those boundaries shifted depending upon time and place and circumstance. Who then, for Yvonne and other mid-18th century Freemasons, were the profane? The term came into widespread use in continental European Freemasonry during the 1740s. It appears in various languages, and its use could vary widely. It could, for example, mean anyone outside the lodge, un profane vulgaire, who scorned the bad conduct of Masons who belong to unofficial or clandestine lodges. Such was the usage in the term in Paris in the 1740s, and then in a letter to the Amsterdam Lodge Le Bien Ami from a lodge in Stockholm. This usage conforms to other Masonic language that expressed a tension within the world and presumed its hostility. As we saw in Nijmegen in Amsterdam in the 1750s, traditional Dutch Calvinist piety seemed to be embodied in the world among the profane. Once adopted, the term pervaded Masonic discourse, and in the 1770s, French Freemasons possessed a distinct understanding of time that depended upon their understanding of the profane. The common date was the style vulgaire, whereas Masonic time, which added 4,000 years to any date, 1773 becoming 5773, was enlightened time. The custom of delineating the Masonic time of light from vulgar time can be found in Amsterdam as early as the 1750s. In the 1770s, French Freemasons also began to delineate the society of vulgar men where there is idolatry and tyranny. By contrast, it was claimed that in the lodges could be found this precious equality. In the French lodges of the 1770s and the 1780s, the tensions between the lodges and the profane was increasingly palpable. Imagine that. What's it tell you about us? What does it tell you about us that we need to hear? Oh, get over yourself. I'm not talking about women as objects here. I've spoken with women Freemasons in our country, and they have no desire to be compromised by men being brought into their order. And they're perfectly content. They found Masonry. Good on them. Good on them, I say. See from the clock on the wall that we're at the end of the program again. I'm pulling together for those of you who have been tuning in for a while. I am beginning at the prompting of some very lovely people. I'm beginning to pull together a book from the commentary over the years, and so that it can, the attempt is to reach a broader audience. I don't really see anything about Freemasonry going viral, do you? And anything that would create excitement in a whole, with millions of old guys probably scares the hell out of me. I don't want to be around with that's just too much. I'd rather go walk in the forest and commune with nature. We're doing some of us are doing well, and we don't depend on, if you don't depend on prizes and baubles, you'll do well in Masonry. It continues to press if you're at all capable. If you don't get it from the hop, then, this conversation is meaningless and absolutely meaningless. But if you're struggling, if you have the least inclination to struggle to sort this out, it does have its own rewards. And you will become part of a small, small group in the face of the world, not by intention, but by ability. Very few seem to have the ability to do this, to probe, to pick this up. It's not as obscure as somebody with a taste in some, new age art. It's not that. It's not that kind of, I wish that it was that kind of discovery. This is rediscovering a body of thinking that you can absolutely stretch back into the past millennia into ancient cultures. You can absolutely, and it's fascinating. If this idea, for example, if this idea, we found this idea of inclusiveness developed in this part of the world, at the, how do we explain it, the parallel discoveries at different points in the planet in different ancient cultures? And does it matter? Well, I think Churchill, not exactly the most pleasant human being in the world, but he's been praised for his gift of getting England through a war. As said, the further back we go in history, the further back we look in history, the further forward we can see. And I think he's at a point. I look forward to seeing you again soon, and thank you for tuning in. It's been fun today. I'll see you in a couple of days. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Cheers.